It's another Monday afternoon in Atlanta. It's Political Rewind. Who knows what is going to happen politically in this week, but whatever it is, we will be here to talk about it. Joining me today in the studio, my partner Jim Galloway, the political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. You read him on Thursdays and Sundays in the Dead Tree edition of the paper, and of course, he oversees the political Insider blog. Hey, Jim, glad to have you back. You took Friday off.
I did, and Thursday too. And if you're out in the state, stay there. If you're in Metro Atlanta, welcome to your first day of traffic purgatory.
Theron Johnson, Democratic strategist, is with us again today because he and Brian Robinson, Republican consultant, spending a lot of their Monday afternoons on Political Rewind, which we're really happy about. And we're joined today from New York by Chris Whipple. Chris Whipple is a documentarian, a filmmaker, a journalist. He has won Peabody Awards, Emmys. You know his work from 60 Minutes, where he has produced pieces for them. And now we're talking to you. Chris, welcome from New York. It's good to have you here.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Sure. We're going to talk about your new book, The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency. And Chris, with your indulgence, as we go through the conversation, we're going to let our insiders here. We want to get Theron Johnson, Brian Robinson engaged in this conversation. But let's start by talking first about your book. You interviewed, is it 19 chiefs of staff for this book? Have I got the number
not
right?
Not quite. 17.
17.
Oh, 17 living White House chiefs, two former presidents, including President Jimmy Carter.
Uh-huh.
An awful lot of other sources, too. You know, with the chiefs themselves, you get the view from 30,000 feet, but I wanted the view from the ground up as well. So spoke to many of their colleagues, many of the secretaries of state, national security advisors. It's all in the book.
And again, it's important enough that it's in the title of your book, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency. So you quote, there's a quote in your book about the presidents are defined by the portraits they hang in the Oval Office and the chiefs of staff they hire, right?
Yeah, in fact, that's something that the historian Richard Norton Smith, told me, which I thought was colorful. I mean, the way James Baker, who many regard as the gold standard under Ronald Reagan, the way Baker puts it is you can very well make the argument that the White House chief of staff is the second most powerful job in government. You know, every new chief picks up the phone and calls Baker first if they're smart. And Baker, usually the first thing he tells them is, congratulations, you've got the worst blanking job in Washington.
You open your book with a wonderful gathering of chiefs who came together in January of 2009.
December
right?
5, oh. 2008.
All right. Okay. December of 2008. So it was, we had President-elect Obama getting set to take office, and Rahm Emanuel was going to become his chief of staff. And this great group, including Ted Duberstein, John Podesta, Rumsfeld, Cheney, Leon Panetta, and they all have advice for Rahm Emanuel. I worked with Rahm Emanuel during some of those days, and I don't think Rahm Emanuel took anybody's advice. Do you, Chris?
Well, I don't know. Maybe not. Absolutely extraordinary day, extraordinary story. 13 living White House chiefs came at the invitation of Josh Bolton, George W.'s outgoing chief, to see Rahm. And you know, again, ranging from Dick Cheney and Rumsfeld to Podesta and Rahm, and, you know, to show him,
did Cheney say what he actually said, what you said he said?
Cheney put it, he said, we wanted to show him the keys of the men's room, as he put it. There have been no female White House chiefs. But anyway, they went around the table, and Ken Duberstein, Reagan's final chief, told Rahm, dramatically, never forget that when you open your mouth, it's not you who's speaking, it's the President of the United States.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
To which Rahm said, oh, blank. this brought down the room. Anyway, they finally got to Cheney after everybody else gave their advice, and Cheney again looked at him gravely up over his glasses and said, "At all costs, control your vice president."
Now, is
so
it,
some of it was not entirely serious, but at the same time, they did give him some. This was a moment of crisis that almost transcended partisanship, if you can believe that these days. But, you know, the country was on the verge of a Great Depression. The auto industry was about to go belly up. Credit was frozen. Two wars were mired in stalemate. And all of these guys came together to try to give Rahm some good advice. Go figure.
So if we can, Chris, there are lots of great stories about many chiefs of staff, but this show airs statewide in Georgia. And so let's talk a little bit about the Carter presidency. And I think people here are going to be fascinated by your reporting on that. The starting for that is, I mean, we know that Carter came into the White House with an enormously ambitious agenda, energy policy. He was going to revamp the tax code. He had inflation to deal with. He had such a huge agenda, but he did not choose a chief of staff. Talk to us about that.
It is, you know, one of the fascinating chapters in the book, and to my mind, and I think it's a story that a lot of people don't really know. Maybe everybody in Georgia does, but you know, Jack Watson was in charge of Carter's transition, and Jack, although he's not a household name like Cheney and Rummy and Rahm, he's a fascinating guy, and he did a first-rate job organizing Carter's transition, and he was the, you know, the apparent White House chief of staff. I think the expectation among a lot of people was that he probably would be. Charles Curbo, who was his, you know, Jack was a protege of Charles Curbo, and who was a very close friend of Carter. And Curbo, on election night, told Carter that he really should make Jack his chief of staff. It's a fascinating story because there's always a tension between the guys who are preparing to govern and the campaigners. And in this case, the campaigners were Ham Jordan, Jody Powell, Gerald Rafshoon, and others. Ham Jordan got wind of this, that Watson was organizing a transition, and there was a rebellion. And Carter really clipped Jack Watson's wings at that point. I mean, the feeling among the true believers, you know, Ham Jordan and Jody Powell and some of the others, was that Jack was too establishment, Jack was too much like Clark Clifford and all those guys that we came to do business differently. We're the outsiders. So it's a fascinating story, and I think that was really determined to some extent the nature of the Carter presidency, the fact that Ham Jordan became... Yeah, he always was the closest to Jimmy Carter. I mean, he was like a son.
Yes, he was. And, yeah.
And so, you know, Ham was always going to be at the center of the Carter White House. The short story is, we can go into it in more detail, but the short story is that Jordan didn't want that job, and he didn't perform it very well. And Carter, coming in, really thought he could run his own White House, and he was chastened by the example of Haldeman, who'd become the poster boy for Watergate. But I don't think Carter understood that Haldeman really knew how to make the trains run.
You know, Brian, I want to pull you into this conversation. It's one of the things that Chris points out in the book is that Carter thought he was the smartest guy in the White House. To some extent,
and he was, and he probably was.
That's right. You say he may have been the smartest president in modern American history, but that perhaps, Brian, that works against you. That you, Chris says he thinks that Reagan is a better example of a guy who understood he didn't know everything and therefore was willing to listen to other people, which is fascinating.
Yeah, it is, and it goes to sort of the different management styles and what works and what doesn't work. You know, I think the problem with the smartest guy in the room syndrome is you always kind of end up with analysis paralysis. And I think you saw a lot of that throughout the Carter administration, a lot of, you know, dithering and not being able to make a decision and lead. And you look forward two decades to President George W. Bush and Theran and all his Democrat buddies painting him as stupid and uneducated and unable to talk. But at the end of the day, the guy can make decisions. And he could make decisions and move on and defend what they did and take the next steps. That, in my experience in government, I've worked in a governor's office and I've worked on Capitol Hill. I think that is the central ingredient, is the ability to come down on a decision and stick with it.
Hey, Chris, let me ask you a question here. Okay, what parallels are there with the Carter organization and the Trump organization?
Yeah, especially in terms of what you're telling us about the tension between Jack Watson and Hamilton Jordan, and what we're watching unfold, even as we're on the air today, between Steve Bannon and Reince Priebus.
Because if I could just add this, I mean, what I'm seeing in the Trump organization is something I've never seen before, and that is you always expect factionalism within a White House, but I've never seen the policy differences within that factionalism so great.
Well, I want to come back to Ham Jordan and Jack Watson in a minute, but just to address that head on, I think we are seeing the most dysfunctional White House in modern history. The level of ineptitude and incompetence is off the charts, and a lot of that is on Priebus. Rookie mistakes galore on his part. I mean, no competent White House chief, certainly Jack Watson or Jim Baker, never would have sent an executive order on immigration out into the world, you know, scrawled on the back of an envelope without running it by the departments that are in charge of enforcing it. I think that repeal and replace Obamacare was a lose-lose from the get-go. The votes weren't there for it. They should have known that. And even if they'd passed it somehow, it would have come back to bite them because so many people would have lost coverage, including their base. So this is a rookie operation. And some of that's on Priebus, but fundamentally, ultimately, the problem is with Donald Trump, who is oblivious to history, who has not learned the lesson that every other modern president ultimately learns. And that is, you cannot govern effectively if you don't empower a White House chief of staff as first among equals.
Well, so Theran Johnson, our Democrat, is nodding. He's fist pumping as he hears you say that, Chris. But you know, Theran, I know the Carter people bristle at this. But I want to talk about it anyway. I want you to get in, and then Chris, I want your thought. You know, there are people who like. There are people who have compared Trump, the outsider, coming in to the White House without understanding Capitol Hill, without understanding the Washington establishment, and therefore kind of alienating himself to some extent early in his tenure, to what Carter went through when he came into the White House. He's the outsider. He did not know how to work with the people on Capitol Hill. And I know the Carter people bristle at it, and I don't think we should take it much farther than that very basic comparison of outsiders who don't understand the Washington they're coming into. They're elected because they're outsiders, but then they have to govern understanding the insiders there.
Yeah, and Chris, thank you so much for that wonderful analysis. The panel here would think that we're actually in cahoots. You know, my good friend Brian likes to come up with these conspiracy theories. You know, the biggest difference for me, Bill, and what Chris just outlined, and I totally agree. I mean, we're literally, I think, 12 days away for the first 100 days in this Trump administration. And so the difference between Carter and Trump, even though, and this is great news to me, I mean, I have to admit on air that I was not aware that Carter did not have a chief of staff, but I think that Governor Carter, let's not forget he was a governor from Georgia, unlike Donald Trump, had been able to have some governor experience in leading a southern state. But to your point, Bill, coming in as an outsider to a Congress that was very divided then, but not as divided as it is now, is it's a testament to that president's ability to really bring people in the administration that's going to allow him to have a central view. You know, I somewhat agree with Brian, but I kind of want to, you know, push back a little bit. I think the role of a chief of staff, and more importantly, the candidate, is to put people in the room who are exactly on the opposite sides of the issue. And what that does, you let those folks debate it out, and it gives the president an opportunity to have a central view on the issue. I think what Chris just outlined with this debacle with the Trump Care, and also the very divisive and discriminatory travel ban that was issued, it displayed at front and center how this president doesn't want people who he thinks is smarter than him in the room, but these are just a carryover of people who were from the campaign who he trusts and be around. I think that this president, if you look at who he surrounded himself with, these are all people who he feel comfortable with. Not necessarily that they're the right people to be in the White House to help govern this country. And I think what you're seeing also is that they thought that they could, in a very expedited way, push things, you know, down people's throat and force them to do things like Sally Yates that they necessarily not didn't want to do, but they legally could not do. I think that's the reason why this administration has been so just stagnant to really get out of the gates to really, you know, lead this country.
Chris,
can I point out a couple of big differences between Donald Trump and Jimmy Carter?
Sure.
Number one, the obvious one, is that Carter was the most intelligent president elected in the 20th century. You know, Trump is a third-class intellect and a third-class temperament combined. Which makes having a chief of staff all the more important. He needs one more than any of his predecessors. But the second big difference, among many others, I'm sure, is that Carter and his team actually passed a lot of stuff. I mean, in the early days of that administration, if you sit down with Stu Eisenstadt, who was in charge of domestic policy, he'll give you chapter and verse. They passed more laws than anybody since LBJ. The problem was not that they couldn't pass laws. The problem was, and I think Jimmy Carter himself would admit this, is that he couldn't prioritize. Carter wanted to do everything at once. The result was, you know, he stepped on a lot of toes that made a lot of enemies. Erskine Bowles told me a great story about, you know, Bill Clinton also wanted to do everything and was pretty smart himself. And every day he had 1,000 great ideas. And Bowles would grab him by the shoulders and turn him around and walk him right back into the Oval and shut the door and say, "Mr. President, I told you, you can only do 3 or 4 things. And if you stick to those 3 or 4 things, I can mobilize the resources and the organization to get them done, but you can't do 1,000 things."
Hey, Chris, finish the thought here.
What I'm saying is that's what a chief of staff would have brought to the table with Jimmy Carter: prioritizing, having a consistent message, avoiding obvious mines. And that's something that I think, you know, most of Carter's senior staff agree. Stu Eisenstadt, David Rubenstein, Jerry Rafshoon, I talked to all of them for this chapter. And I think they all agreed that Ham Jordan should have been the Karl Rove in that administration.
Yeah, I mean, Hamilton.
And not the chief.
Right. Many of us have dealt with Hamilton over the years before he passed away. But and he was a genius in many ways, and his ideas kept flying out of him. But he had no ability to organize anything.
Yeah. He was instinctive. Yeah. Hey, Chris, we've got a Republican who's just really squirming here and is just appalled that you have called Jimmy Carter the smartest man ever to inhabit the White House in the 20th century. Can you just kind of fill us in on how you arrived at that conclusion?
He was a nuclear scientist. This is a guy who, you know, if you ask Tip O'Neill or Katherine Graham, or, you know, they both famously said that they thought he was the smartest president they had ever laid eyes on, ever dealt with. Jack Watson is eloquent on this, and he and I are going to be at the Carter Library this week for a session that I'm looking forward to.
Yeah, let me, as long as you mention it, before you continue, you're going to be there Thursday night at the Carter Presidential Library, 7 p.m. talking with Jack, and so people are invited.
If you're having something with Bill Clinton or George W. Bush next week, would they be the smartest president of the 20th century?
Brian. Go finish your thought, one. Chris.
Jimmy Carter was somebody who could... He could talk to you about the throw weight of nuclear warheads, and then quote Reinhold Niebuhr. I mean, this is a guy who not only knew how to govern, but he was a first rate intellect. That doesn't always translate into governing effectively, and the lesson, you know, 2.5 years in, Carter finally realized that he had to have a chief of staff. And then he, of course, named the wrong guy,
right.
Cam Jordan. He should have had Jack Watson from day one, in my opinion.
Theron?
And I want to stand corrected. I know Brian and his people who like to troll this show on Twitter, it's actually 19 days to go, not 12 days. Hey, Chris, I want to go back to Rahm Emanuel. I don't want to get in this Carter debate between you and Brian. But in that interview or in that session that you talked about when all the chiefs of staffs came back and they interview was, you know, really kind of just conversed and talked to.
They gave Rahm advice.
Gave Rahm advice. Did they ever talk about giving Rahm advice on how to? And I assume that none of them. Well, not assume none of them had done this before. But did they talk about the climate in which Rahm Emanuel, who was a congressman who was very close to the Clintons, who Barack Obama defeated in the primary, but being the first African-American president and dealing with the issues of race and having to be a chief of staff to the first African-American president who had a very bold agenda, as you pointed out, those two or three things that he focused on was bailing out the automobile industry. He passed the economic stimulus package. And also, a lot of folks don't give him credit. He actually restored a lot of funding to the SCHIP program. Did the issue of race and with Barack Obama being the first African-American president and how Rahm Emanuel could help run that White House, did that ever come up in that discussion?
I don't believe it did, and nor do I think any of those guys would have had any good advice. Rahm and Obama were on their own at that point. I mean, Rahm did tell me that as he was walking across the West Wing parking lot into the West Wing that morning, he was thinking about the fact that you had an economy in free fall, credit frozen, on the verge of the Great Depression, two wars. He was reminded of the headline in The Onion: "Black man gets worst job in Washington."
and that's kind of where I was going with this, because, you know, a lot of us on the Democratic side, I mean, we were sort of not shocked, because we knew that there was a prior consistent relationship there between him and now Mayor Emanuel because of Chicago. But Rahm Emanuel, when he successfully took back the Congress with the DCCC, was a very direct, my way or the highway type of leader.
Yeah.
And did you see that sort of translate over into the White House?
Yeah, no question about it. There was some tension between Rahm on the one hand. This is reminiscent of the Carter White House. There was tension between Rahm and the true believers in the Obama camp. These were the guys on the campaign trail. You know, the guys who thought we're coming in to change Washington. We don't want to be like Clinton.
Chris, we don't want to. Go ahead, finish that, because then I got to get to a break. So
sure.
Take another 10 seconds or so to finish that.
So there
thought.
Was a little tension there, but you know, underneath that brash persona of Emanuel's, he's a true bleeding heart liberal.
We do have to get to a break. Chris, you can stay with us for one more segment, I hope.
Sure,
good.
Absolutely.
Jim Galloway, you're going to have to leave us. Tell everybody quickly, you're on your way to a 6th District event.
Yeah, I've got to go see Evan McMullen, who's making an appearance on behalf of Mr. Abrams, one of the 18 candidates
whose name no one has known, and maybe even after Evan McMullen is there for him, they still may not know.
But I'm still going to chance the traffic.
Okay, Jim Galloway, thank you. We got a hard time going up there. Lisa... Clark has just brought a news headline into me. We're going to take a break after. Four victims reported after an elementary school shooting in San Bernardino. the shooter is possibly down. That comes, at least the initial report that Lisa's looking at, from KTLA, one of the local TV stations in Los Angeles. So that's a story that obviously will get a lot of attention throughout the afternoon. Thank you for that, Lisa. We are here with Theron Johnson, Brian Robinson, and with us from New York, Chris Whipple, author of The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Defined Every Presidency. Let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, how healthcare became big business. We'll talk to Elizabeth Rosenthal, author of An American Sickness, about how the pricing and billing of medical services, devices, and prescription drugs became so complicated, even some doctors don't understand it. She's the editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News. Before becoming a journalist, she was a physician. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
GPB's Spring Fund Drive begins soon, but don't wait. Your contribution now at gpb.org before the drive starts will do twice the good. You'll support the programs you enjoy, and your gift will be part of our challenge fund to inspire others to join you in supporting GPB. You'll also have a chance to win a St. Simon's Island getaway to the King and Prince Beach and Golf Resort. That's gpb.org, and thanks.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. It's Monday afternoon, which means when we are really lucky, we're able to coordinate Brian Robinson and Theron Johnson's schedules to get them in here together to do the show. And joining us from New York, Chris Whipple, author of The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency. Chris, you're hard on the Trump administration and certainly on the chaos that we've seen up there, Bannon, Priebus, Jared Kushner, all of those players. But just to make a different point about this, it is not as if, and you certainly found this in your book, it is not as if past administrations haven't had a certain amount of turmoil in the earliest days of their tenures in getting their senior people in position, is it? I mean, this is not unusual.
Well, but the degree is off the charts compared to previous administrations, in my opinion. This is just chaos and unprecedented, and that's largely because the guy in charge, Donald Trump, has he thinks that this is somehow like running a real estate firm in Manhattan. It is nothing like it. Governing is really, really difficult. And what every predecessor learned, often the hard way, is that you cannot govern without an empowered White House chief of staff. They all figure it out eventually. I mean, Jimmy Carter, it took him 2.5 years to figure that out, and he finally got a really first-rate guy in Jack Watson in place during his last year. Bill Clinton, it's a terrific story. I mean, Clinton came in. He'd spent all of his time choosing his cabinet, almost none of his time choosing his White House staff, which is more important. And he wound at the last minute picking an old friend from kindergarten named Mac McLarty, who was a really smart, very able businessman, but he didn't know Capitol Hill. He didn't know the White House. And more importantly, because he was Bill Clinton's good friend, he couldn't discipline Clinton.
And I'm glad you mentioned McLarty and that first Clinton administration, because it takes me right to where I wanted to go with you in the conversation. So McLarty comes in as Clinton's first chief of staff. And as you say, he's a childhood friend. He was also, McLarty was just a really nice, kind of gentle human being.
Mac the Nice.
Yeah. And you point out that when it was time for him to move on, they brought in Leon Panetta, and it was George, I think, Stephanopoulos, you tell us, who said to Panetta, "You have got to be a tough chief of staff." And your book is filled with quotes from people who essentially say one version of that or another. And Brian Robinson,
they were on Air Force One on their way to Europe, and Stephanopoulos took Panetta aside. He'd gotten wind of the fact that Panetta was a contender to replace McLarty, and he said, and he had a copy of H.R. Haldeman's diaries, and he pulled it out and he turned to page whatever it was, and where Haldeman described this scene, and he said, "You have to be the Lord High Executioner, just like Haldeman." And Panetta came in. It was almost an intervention by friends and administration officials. They told Clinton that he had to make a change. Panetta came in. Panetta was described as an iron fist inside a velvet glove. You know, you don't have to be a son of a bitch like Haldeman or John Sununu, for example. Panetta had it all. I mean, Panetta was grounded. He had common sense. He was a charmer. He was popular, but he could lower the boom. And he and Erskine Bowles just turned that presidency around, in my opinion, by organizing the White House and making it run.
Brian, you were a deputy chief of staff for Governor Deal in his first term, and you worked with a tough chief of staff. You worked with a chief. You know, I don't want you to have to go too far in talking about your former
don't laugh too hard.
Colleague, but Governor Nathan Deal's chief of staff has always been known as a brass knuckles kind of guy, yeah?
I think that every executive and their chief of staff needs to have this reciprocal, symbiotic, complementary relationship. If you have a principal, the elected official, who's a people pleaser, or somebody who suffers from analysis paralysis, that chief of staff has to be someone who can crack the whip, someone who can say no, and someone who can force the principal to make a decision and stick with it. And so they've got to have that. In the relationship between Chris Riley and Governor Deal, they've been together for 25 years. I mean, it really is almost unprecedented that you have a relationship that goes that far back. So there's almost a mind meld. I mean, Chris knows at any given time exactly where the governor's going to be on an issue and the way he would want it handled. And that's and with that knowledge and with that trust and that loyalty that there is between the two of them, Chris is able to make decisions that the governor is on an international trip or if the governor is in meetings and there's something that comes up. Chris is able to make a decision, and the governor is going to back him up because the governor knows that he is acting in his name and doing the things that the governor would want him to do.
Chris, is there any example in administrations since Nixon of a relationship that long-lasting between a chief of staff and a president?
Well, yeah, I'm just thinking now how, you know, Erskine Bowles was very close with Bill Clinton.
Yeah.
They both married Wellesley girls, as he likes to point out. They both loved to play golf together. They're pretty good friends, but Bowles understood that he reported to the president, unlike some other chiefs like Sununu and Don Regan, famously. Let me just go back, if I could,
sure.
To you asked me if the Trump situation is unprecedented.
Yeah.
And in one sense, it's not. I can think of a case that where there was internecine warfare like this, almost Game of Thrones, you know, in the White House, and that was Ronald Reagan's White House. Now, Jim Baker had Ed Meese as a rival, you know, Reagan's chief of staff from Sacramento. He had the hard right guys who always said, let Reagan be Reagan. They came after Baker with everything they had, and you know, he had Mike Deaver was practically family, almost maybe the Jared Kushner of this White House. He had Nancy Reagan, a lot of powerful forces to contend with. But Baker was so savvy that he made Nancy an ally. He made Deaver an ally. And then he was able to deal with Meese and the hardliners who came after him. You know, they were the hated so-called pragmatists in the Reagan White House. But boy, did Jim Baker know how to play that game.
Yeah, you talk about Don Regan. You have a great quote. You say that Don Regan took over as chief of staff when Howard Baker went on to Treasury, and you talk about him being a flashy guy. And you say
James Baker, yeah.
Jim Baker, I'm sorry. Jim Baker. But Regan added a new protocol, you say, that before he entered a room, he would be announced, and you quote, ladies and gentlemen, the chief of staff to the president of the United States. You know, Brian Robinson wanted something like that when he at the governor's office, and Chris Riley wouldn't let him have it.
I also wanted entry music. I wanted entry music, and I'd already picked out some tunes.
Chris,
I always say, that was unusual. Ken Duberstein, Reagan's last chief, told me that Don Reagan thought he was the CEO and that Reagan was the retired chairman of the board.
So we're gonna have to take a break. And before we do, a couple of notes. First of all, Chris Whipple, it's really been a great pleasure to have you here. I do want to let people know that on this Thursday night, you'll be at the Carter Presidential Library. I repeat it again. That ought to be a great session. You and Jack Watson talking about your book, and I assume sharing really interesting stories. You obviously talked to Jack for the book. By the way, before we cut you loose, you also talked to Carter himself, right?
I did.
Tell us, before we cut you loose, what did you find that was particular? What did Carter tell you that really stood out in your mind as he talked about this subject?
Well, what really stood out, well, first of all, we talked about a lot of things, including the Osama bin Laden raid, which, of course, Carter felt that, maybe his experience had something to do with Obama adding an extra helicopter. Anyway, that was fascinating.
Wow.
But the other really fascinating thing about Jimmy Carter, in my mind, was that he's such a proud, understandably, rightfully, man. He looks back and he says he wouldn't have done anything differently at the outset. He says he didn't think that Rumsfeld or Cheney had performed particularly admirably as chief of staff under Gerald Ford. Fascinating to me that he might have done it all over again the way he did it.
That is really an interesting statement, and it does say an awful lot about the self-assurance of Jimmy Carter and maybe the stubbornness of Jimmy Carter as well.
A little of both, absolutely.
The book is The Gatekeeper. It's by Chris Whipple. Chris, you'll be at the Carter Library at 7 o'clock Thursday night. People who listen to this show and our other show, Two-Way Street, know that we do shows over there all the time, so people know it's free admission. I would get there early because I suspect there's going to be a big crowd to see Chris Whipple on Thursday evening. Am I also right that you've got a documentary, because you are a documentary filmmaker, there's a documentary in which we're going to be able to see some of the interviews you did with these chiefs, right?
We did a documentary for Discovery back in 2013 on the White House chiefs, and perhaps we'll play a few clips.
Is that available anywhere at this point, or is it you just got to search around and hope to find?
You
got to
search around.
Right.
You know, it's not easy to find.
Chris Whipple, thank you so much for joining us. The book is really terrific. The Gatekeepers, How the White House Chiefs of Staff Define Every Presidency. You've got a lot of political junkies who listen to this show, Chris, and I think they're going to want to pick up your book. So thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having
Bye-bye.
Me.
Bye-bye. We're going to take a break. Quick update. The police chief in San Bernardino, Jared Bergwin, says that two adults at this elementary school are deceased in the shooting. They believe it was a murder-suicide. Two students were apparently or possibly wounded. They're in the hospital, condition unknown. So just another awful day at a school, unfortunately, in America. It's 2:44 on Monday afternoon. We're going to take a break and come back and spend some time talking to Brian Robinson and Theron Johnson.
Now's your chance to win a beach getaway for two and support GPB at the same time. Your contribution at gpb.org will give our spring fund drive a strong start. You'll also enter to win a St. Simons Island getaway for two at the King and Prince Beach and Golf Resort, including a three-night oceanfront stay, meals, and golf. No contributions required to enter the drawing, but because you listen, we are counting on your support. That's gpb.org, and thanks.
Here we go, back on Political Rewind, Theron Johnson and Brian Robinson. They're already talking. They don't pay any attention to me, which is perfectly fine. So another day, another article in a national newspaper. I pick up the Washington Post this morning. There's a piece about the 6th District race. Of course, most of it focused on the Democratic candidate, Theron Johnson, who you've been giving a good deal of help to out there. Every show, and I've said to our listeners, I will on every show between now and the election say, how does a Democrat win this race without winning it outright in the first go-round?
Well, you know, I said in a piece that I was interviewed on last week, and it came out over the weekend, the New York Daily News. And what I said was that John Ossoff really, to me, represents the resistance that we're seeing against this president, President Trump. But also, I think that he is a symbol of Democratic prosperity in the future. So let me just go a little deeper in that. What we're seeing here is a young man who's 30 years old, who's never held political office before, but had the courage to step up and say, hey, listen, I want to run for Congress because I want to go to Washington and be an independent voice for the District 6. And also what he's done is that he's raised a remarkable amount of money, you know, now $8.2 million, to really get this message out in a way.
That point two is from Georgia. That point
right.
two.
That's true.
Yeah.
But the thing that's been so interesting is that when I met with John a few months ago, the first thing I told him, Bill, I said, listen, man, you're going to run for Congress. You got to get out here. You got to define yourself. And you got to basically have a message that not only motivates Democrats, but also you've got to make sure that you focus on independents and moderates in that district. The one thing that's so interesting, how does a Democrat win that race? Listen, we know this, and Brian is going to give us a lot of this, data here in a second about how the district is so over, you know, so packed with Republicans, and then I'll come back and say that Donald Trump won it by 1% in a presidential election year. But if you look at the momentum, particularly with the early vote numbers, Bill, when you see 55% of the people who pulled a ballot on day one in early voting in this district, 55% of those folks had a strong Democratic voting record. Now, that number has dwindled down.
Yeah, it's dramatically gotten closer.
Yeah, it's gotten closer. But what you see in this race is the momentum. Now, here's the bottom line. What John Ossoff has got to do, and I've said this publicly, he's got to figure out a way, and I think he's doing it. He's got to figure out a way to talk about the issues that matters most to the people who live in that district. I mean, of course, right now, a lot of folks are thinking about transportation and infrastructure because of the 85 bridge collapse. But more importantly, he's got to make a pivot at the most, I think, you know, it's got to be calculated. Where he's got to appeal to these Republican voters because it's just not enough Democrats alone to elect him in that district. But the one thing that it's been very interesting is that when you hear people in Washington like Steve Bannon saying that he's running a good campaign, and you look at the amount of people in that district who are voting for him early, it's still an uphill battle, but I think that he's going to have the money and the resources to be competitive.
So, Brian, we need to say, first of all, as we've done before, you have a horse in this race. You're working with Judson Hill.
Yes, former state senator.
So that's fine. But when I hear Theron talk about John Ossoff, a young guy just getting started, it sounds like he's suggesting this will be a first race and it'll get him established. I mean, he really does sound a little bit like he's saying there's a future for this guy beyond this race.
And that may be true. Now, he's not going to raise $8.3 million again.
No,
that's
but
not
my point is it
again.
Sounds like Theron is already suggesting this is going to be a very tough race for him to win, and this just a nice way to start.
Look, I give the Democrats credit because they have organized very well. I live in the Brookhaven section of the 6th District, and my neighborhood, demographically, economically, you would think if you were put at gunpoint and asked, are these Democrats or Republicans, you would just assume they're Republicans, and there are John Ossoff signs all over my neighborhood. And you don't see any on the Republican side. Now, signs don't mean all that much if you're a political operative, but still, it does show some level of organization and a level of significant resources. What I don't understand about Ossoff, and this is another area where I give him credit, is why him? There are other legitimate Democrats who could have emerged in this district. He had the least name ID, the least amount of establishment backing, and then kind of came out of nowhere.
Well,
to
I
be
suppose
the guy.
It has to do with John Lewis and Hank Johnson, doesn't it, Theron?
Well, let me say this, and I want to be clear because I know a lot of folks who support this campaign or listening to this show. I am not suggesting that this is going to be a moral victory or a fail first attempt for John Ossoff. Let me be very clear.
Although both are true.
No. No. I'm telling you, listen, and Brian knows this. Brian and I, we debate at least once a week. When we start talking about this race 3 or 4 months ago, Brian and I were both kind of like, okay, let's really kind of see how this turns out because there was so many people in the race.
Yeah.
You got to give this guy credit, Bill. He has not only went out here and raised the money, he is running a very message disciplined campaign. Even when the Republicans tried to catch him on this whole, whether he was a national aide and whether he was in school or not. I mean, a PolitiFacts came out this weekend to show that it was half true. So he does have some national security experience as being a national security aide. I mean, he has run a very disciplined campaign. So let me be very clear where I am on this race. To me, and why him, and to Brian's point, Brian, I think a part of this is that a lot of folks in November, when you were out celebrating, you know, with your Georgia sweatshirt on, and you were happy for Donald Trump becoming president of the United States, those other 3 million people who, by the way, did not vote for him but voted for Hillary Clinton, and the millions and millions of others, Democrats across the country, I think we say, you know what, we've got to roll up our sleeves, and this is an opportunity for us to come together. I think that that young man having the guts and the courage to step out on faith and to say, I want to represent my country because I think that I want to run for office and represent the 6th District, and I want to be a part of this transition that our country is going through, was something that was very honorable of him. Now, did he think he was probably going to be doing this good this early? Probably not. But I think that he is the symbol of what a lot of people in your neighborhood, and it's a very wealthy neighborhood. I visited your home. There's some very nice houses over there, 3-car garages, you know, well-manicured lawn. I mean, and if you wrote down the street that I wrote down this week, I was in Brookhaven, and I saw people all on the corners, white, black, Hispanic, Asian Americans, holding John Ossoff signs. Bill, yep. Don't count this guy.
Oh, I'm not counting him out.
I just wonder how many of them, like John Ossoff, actually live in the 4th District.
Oh, Brian, let me ask you. We got it. We got the dig. Ossoff does not live in the district.
Do his parents
live in the district? Because it seems like
I don't know.
The reason I ask is he keeps doing interviews at his parents'
house.
His girlfriend.
I mean, talking about your typical millennial candidate, right. Like running from the basement of his parents' house.
No, let's be fair on this show because we're a fair and balanced show most of the time. He lives with his girlfriend who is in medical school right now, and they want to continue to live there.
But Brian, so let me ask you, because so much attention is focused on Ossoff, and the Republicans, your candidate, Karen Handel, others in this race, have not gotten quite the attention that Ossoff is getting. Is it an advantage to you to be a little bit under the media radar, on the free media radar, or is that harmful in some way? And how are you going to catch? I mean, the polls show your guy is going to have a struggle to catch up to Karen Handel to be in
that
runoff.
I disagree with that. That last part because, you know, Dan Moody, who has spent $2 million on the air and leaked a internal poll last week, showed that it's Handel, Moody, and Judson all bunched up together.
Yes, okay.
All three are where they want to be. I'd say all three except for Karen, because Karen's obviously on a downward trajectory if those numbers are true, and the other two are on an upward trajectory, which is where you want to be this far out from April 18th. But what Ossoff has helped on the earned media front, I agree, he does suck up all of the attention.
Yeah.
But because of him, because of these numbers that he's posting, because he's 20 points ahead of any Republican who are dividing up the vote, we're getting a lot of national attention and local attention on this race that would not be there otherwise. I am a former Congressional Hill staffer, which, you know, I guess watching John Ossoff's campaign, I was a staffer so long, I should be president or UN Secretary General or something. And
you kind of look a little bit like Sergio. I think you'd be more of a Masters champion.
Yeah, Sergio, yeah. Tim Kaine, we all call it. Yeah. And so Ossoff has brought a lot of attention. And as someone who's been in this earned media business in politics, there's no local or national interest in congressional races anymore because congressmen have so little power because nothing gets passed. They can't earmark anymore. And because of that, they raise less money. So a lot of these races are much lower profile than they were 20 years ago. So Ossoff, this being a standalone, there's only two or three congressional races going on right now, all from people who are picked by Trump to take another job. Those seats opened up. And we're getting a ton of attention, like you said, Bill, on the front page of the Washington Post today.
Well, I think the thing also, let's just back up for a second. So when we all knew that once Donald Trump was elected president, that it was highly likely that Congressman Price, Chairman Price, was going to be a strong nominee for the Department of Health and Human Services secretary job. I think Republicans fell asleep at the wheel, Bill. I mean, because I think a lot of them said, okay, he's going to get nominated. It didn't take as long as they would have thought. And so what John did is that John really got to work. I mean, when we really look at where this money is coming from, and I said this in the article as well, I have people from Chicago, L.A., New York, Florida, folks wanting to get involved in this campaign. And I'll tell you why, because, again, it was the one seat that, you know, people really want to focus on Georgia. You know, we hear a lot of conversations about Arizona and a lot of, you know, conversations about North Carolina. But Georgia, Bill, is where the demographics are shifting. And to me, that this district, to me, is an illustration of how the state kind of looks right now, but it's trending towards,
which is
that the one thing that I also want to point out is, and the one thing that hasn't been said, I want to say on the show, there is a great deal of Hispanics that live in this district too. There was an increase of about 16,000 to 17,000 Hispanic voters who showed up in the presidential election year, many of whom, if not all of them, because I don't want to think all of them did, but maybe most of them voted for Hillary Clinton against Donald Trump.
All right, we are just about out of time, but I don't want to let this go without pointing out that, speaking of special congressional elections, Mike Pompeo, of course, became CIA director under Donald Trump. And tomorrow in Kansas, there's going to be a special election to replace him. Now, Trump won by big percentages there, much bigger than he did in the 6th congressional district. But this race between Ron Estes, the Republican candidate, and James Thompson, the Democrat, everybody is going to be watching to see whether or not the Democrats, they may not win the race, but the question is, how close can they come, right, Brian? And that's another race that tells us something about Trump.
They're very much in the same situation as we are in the 6th. National attention on that. Interestingly, less than the 6th, even though it's the 1st, because the Republican will win. That's just a matter of how big the margin is going to be. But let me say on the 6th, as we finish out here, here's what's going to happen, is that Ossoff is going to win the plurality of the vote on April the 18th. He'll have over 40%. Here's Ossoff's problem. In polling, he's nobody's second choice. Nobody's.
Yeah. We've mentioned that on the show. It is a problem for him.
That 40%, 43, 45, that is his ceiling. He can't go high. But the Democrats are going to be mobilized. They're going to pour millions more, and then they're going to be so heartbroken in June.
That's why,
that's going to be awesome.
All right, I got to take it back. But I will say, on your behalf, Theron, that's why Theron Johnson says that John Ossoff has to make a pivot, because he is nobody's second choice, certainly in this race. And if he's going to possibly win what we expect to be a runoff, it's got to be a big, strong pivot. We are completely out of time. Theron, Brian, you know we love having you here on a Monday afternoon. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks, man.
And thanks to our great team, Jenny, Tyler, Lisa, thank you for everything today. We're done. We'll be back Wednesday at 2 o'clock. We're going to talk about how the media covered President Trump's missile strikes. Did the media go too far in giving him praise? Did he deserve the way he was essentially lionized by much of the mainstream media? It's an interesting case study, and we'll talk about it Wednesday at 2 o'clock. I'm Bill Nygut. See you then.